This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hi, my name's Ange Barry, and I'm the CEO of Joy 94.9, Australia's only LGBTIQ community radio station. I'm new to Joy, but Joy's been around for 26 years. We want to be around for another 26 years, and to do that, we need to grow. My vision for the future is for Joy to become Joy Nation, a combination of video, news and editorial, and of course, the great radio station that you love. We are so grateful for the support that our community has provided us over the years, but we are now reaching out to you, our friends in the broader Australian community, to help make this happen. So I'm asking you now to choose Joy by going to joy.org.au and donating to our Chuff campaign, helping us raise $250,000 to build Joy Nation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12, on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Macca here. Tass is joining us as well, and I think we have Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation, on the phone. Misha, of course, you've been working from home now for a number of weeks. Have you gone stir-crazy yet?
No, not yet, although I think I have done a very good job of cleaning out pretty much every cupboard in the house.
We had the hard rubbish collection in our area this week, and there seemed to be even more than usual. So it's probably a good thing people are doing. Look, Misha, we wanted to start off, because we've got you for a couple of segments this morning, wanted to start off with George Pell, and I wanted to make a statement here that I accept the judgment of the court. At the end of the day, if there's doubt, let the person out. But I also say that the community needs to have absolute faith in the justice system, but also faith in the ability of jurors to get it right after listening to all the evidence. We have an appeals process for a reason, and the only comment I make is, as I said, I accept the judgment of the High Court. Doesn't mean I agree with it, but I make the point that the evidence they had was transcripts, not video. So they didn't see the evidence. All they got to do was read it.
That's right. And I think that's the really interesting question here. Look, like you, Macca, I think that, there's been a process and we have to accept the outcome of that process. It's impossible from the distance that everyone's observing this to know, you know, whether Pell is guilty or innocent. We have to sort of, you know, take the process on face value. But I think the really interesting question is this. In the criminal justice system in Australia, there's a principle which is that the jury is the fact-finding body and that judges and others in the process will not interfere in an unwarranted way with the findings of the fact-finding body, which is the jury of peers. Now, in this case, the jury found Pell guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Actually, the first jury was unable to reach a verdict, but the second jury in the county court found him guilty. That decision was upheld by the Court of Appeal in Victoria, and now it's been overturned by the High Court. Generally speaking, the idea is that judges should be reticent to overturn a jury verdict unless there is an error of law or something which is demonstrably incorrect that needs to be rectified. Mm. In this case, what it looks like, and you just alluded to it, Macca, was the High Court read the transcripts. It didn't hear the evidence of the complainant in the same way that the original trial did, nor that the actual Court of Appeal did, because they actually also watched the video evidence as well. And on the basis of that evidence, the High Court has effectively substituted, in my view, its own jury verdict, which is somewhat problematic. Its argument basically is that no reasonable jury could have found Pell guilty beyond reasonable doubt, given the evidence that what happened was somewhat improbable. However, a jury did find that, Yeah. That's actually what happened in the county court trial. The jury did find, after hearing the complainant and weighing the evidence of improbability, that it was satisfied beyond reasonable doubt with regard to the complainant's evidence that he was guilty. So it's sort of interesting. Basically, you've got the High Court saying it doesn't trust what the jury found based on the evidence that it heard, and it's prepared to substitute its own decision and its own weighing of that evidence of improbability for the decision of the original jury. And that is problematic.
It's
problematic for a number of reasons, one of which is the High Court makes decisions about which matters to hear on appeal. In the Pell case, it heard sort of the leave to appeal application at the same time as actually hearing the appeal itself. There are many people who claim that they are innocent who don't get the right to appeal to the High Court. And often it's because they're basically just saying that the jury got it wrong. So why in this instance? It really does open a big door in terms of what the court's role is in terms of rethinking what juries have decided.
And what it says to me...
Mission.
Sorry, Tass, I just wanted to say...
Sorry, Becca.
There are... As I said, I accept the verdict. I don't necessarily agree with it, but what the High Court have said is that there are now 13 people they don't believe, which is the person who gave the survivor and the 12 members of the jury.
Well, and also the majority of the appeals court.
Well, okay, let's make it 15.
Yeah. That's right. And look, it's interesting because one of the interesting things here is the evidence of improbability is evidence about what normally happened, right? And what the processes are and, you know, the robes that the cardinal was wearing and all these things which said basically the alleged incidents were improbable, right? But that only goes to a general pattern. You've got to counterbalance that against the evidence of the complainant that said here's what actually did happen and gave, you know, very detailed evidence under cross-examination from Robert Richter. And it's interesting that the High Court was willing to give more weight to the fact that something was unlikely as opposed to the evidence that actually it did happen, you know, at somebody's individual account. So, look, it's a really interesting decision. Some people are trying to paint it as a indictment on Victoria's criminal justice system. Paul Kelly in The Australian today wrote a long piece basically saying, you know, Pell was vilified by the ABC and the media and, you know, the court was trying him for, you know, basically the sins of the Catholic Church, not his individual case. I don't think that's true. I think that the court process was very much a court process about Pell's guilt or innocence. No defence barrister and no judge would allow it to be otherwise. But, you know, I do think that the High Court's final decision raises a really interesting set of questions.
Does Tass, go for it.
Oh, look, I was actually going to ask you, Misha, what you thought that this means for the Victorian legal system, given, or the Victorian court system, given that in many respects this is a very serious slap in the face for the judiciary and the way in which the Victorian court hearing took place. What are your reflections on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I don't know. In one sense, you could say, yes, it is a slap in the face. I mean, it was an unanimous High Court decision. It was a very strong decision by 7 High Court judges. It is a hierarchy. And in that hierarchy, there is always a process by which subordinate courts get a slap in the face or things are, you know, overturned from time to time. So in a way, it's not an unusual functioning of that process. And I would say those who are casting it as an indictment on the Victorian criminal justice system, I think we need to look at that, you know, those three Court of Appeal judges and their judgments and the sophistication of their reasoning and the original jury trial and explain really, you know, in what way that process is being indicted. I actually think it's more interesting in terms of it's a departure from the High Court has taken an approach that I think you could argue is somewhat divergent to its previous approach of being fairly reticent about disturbing jury verdicts.
And I would say, you know, my view is I do not want an innocent person to do jail time. I do not. But I also want justice for survivors. And unfortunately, those two things have to coexist.
That's right. And look, in this instance, the complainant, the accuser, has accepted the outcome in, you know, I think, a very sort of gracious way, and I think we all have to accept the outcome. I don't think there's any sort of two ways about that. It's just very interesting the way in which the decision of the High Court, as you said at the beginning, which was based on transcripts and on really on evidence of something being improbable, was able to find that that raised enough doubt to disturb a jury verdict when the jury heard the complainant in detail and heard the complainants, sort of being cross-examined by Richter.
Yeah.
Misha, in your assessment, what's been the community reaction to this verdict?
I think it's been people are obviously those who are victims of abuse and who are concerned more broadly with the conduct of the Catholic Church are disappointed. But I think that everybody who has been involved has actually behaved very well. I think everybody has basically acknowledged that this decision is now, quashed the conviction and Pell is a free man. And I think there's been a broad respect for the decision. I think that what's been going on in the past week has really been trying to work out what it means. And I think you've raised really the two things that it may mean most significantly, one of which is, what does it mean for the Victorian criminal justice system? Has the Victorian criminal justice system misfunctioned somehow here? I don't think that that's established. Has the High Court changed its way of behaving? I think to some extent, yes. I think this is to some extent new ground. What does this mean for victims coming forward in future and their chances of getting justice? I think that remains to be seen. That's a future prediction.
I think as a survivor, this is really, it's really difficult. Coming up against the system is incredibly difficult. It's really hard. And to think that you can go through a process, one of reporting it, going through the police process, then going through a preliminary trial process, then a trial process, and then for that to be overturned, and this is over a period of many years, that just tears my heart out for the survivor. I also feel, for George Pell, I put aside my personal view. The reality is, he ran the gauntlet of the justice system, as did the survivor. Ultimately, a decision was made. Is this going to make it harder and more difficult for survivors to come forward? I think in a lot of cases it will, and that is the greatest injustice as a result of this, that it's going to be harder for some people, for some survivors, to come forward.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, Macca and Tass. Tass is remotely looking out the window in St Kilda, looking very happy with himself. I'm in a different studio to Paul. I'm also the duty manager here today. And we have Misha Ketchell, the editor of The Conversation, on the line. Tass, you wanted to particularly ask a question. You want to talk about democracy a little bit, I believe.
Well, I was particularly interested in what Misha's reflections on this topic might be. There's been a fair bit of discussion in the media of late. We've seen opposition parties at both federal and state level questioning what their role is in this space and whether there is a level of scrutiny that might be taking place. So, Misha, I was interested in your reflections. Do you believe that our parliaments, our governments are working democratically at the moment? What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I think that they're not. I think that there's been a real disdain for the democratic process and for the role of Parliament in the way that this has been handled. And I know it can seem like a second-order issue at a time of crisis, but I think it's really important to understand that what is at stake here is a whole range of precedents that you set for how you're prepared to let your democratic system function. And I think that in many ways we've set some bad precedents here that at some point might come back to bite us on the bum. It's really, important that in a Westminster system in particular, you respect the supremacy of Parliament. The Parliament is the body that is, the people that we elect to represent us. And the executive, the government, is formed out of that Parliament and should be accountable to it. And I think what we've got is a lot of rhetoric around, you know, sort of a war footing or a crisis footing, which to some extent, you know, obviously is justified. But it's sort of being used to justify the suspension of Parliament in Australia. Whereas if you look over the rest of the world, that's not what's happening. Parliament's continuing in the UK, it's continuing in the US, it's continuing in Canada, it's continuing in New Zealand. And there's no reason why it couldn't continue in Australia.
What do you think, Misha? You know, there's a particular point of view that the federal opposition leader should be part of the national... I think they're calling it a war... Anyway, the national cabinet would equally, if we accept that, or that we think, OK, that's a good idea, do you then, is the next step, OK, so Michael O'Brien, the Victorian opposition leader, should be part of this Victorian, this cabinet of, or as he calls it, the Gang of Eight. What's your view on that?
I think the answer is yes. I think that they should be. It's one of those things where, interestingly, obviously in a time of crisis like this, we do have to rally around our leaders, and that's very important. But simultaneously, that can be distortionary to the political process because the oppositions do get sidelined, they do get somewhat silenced. And part of the idea is if we believe in a process where we have people who are there to present a counterpoint of view, to represent individuals in the community who have different beliefs or are suggesting different proposals or amendments or different ways of doing things, our whole parliamentary system is based on the idea that that's productive. How is it suddenly not productive now to have the opposition involved in the discussion? I sort of don't understand how something that works all of the time, suddenly now we're in a situation where we say, this doesn't work. There would be huge pressure on the opposition, and clearly there is federally, and there clearly is at a state level, to not be intransigent, to not be unduly oppositional, to not hold up processes, to not be petty. You look at the behaviour of Anthony Albanese and Michael O'Brien, and you can see that they are carefully calibrating their comments to be seen to be constructive. They know that that's their role. Why can't they be involved? I just don't understand.
Your thoughts, Tess?
I don't have a fixed view about this at the moment, although I can't understand why Parliament isn't sitting. Mm. I do understand this notion of social distancing, but there are other ways in which you can deliver Parliament and still retain a level of safety. I mean, you know, business is continuing right across the nation. People are, boards are meeting, teams are meeting, individuals are meeting, people are using technology to make that work. I can't see why Parliament should not also be sitting. It feels to me like there is an argument around these are extraordinary times and therefore we should be doing things very differently. I'm not sure that that really cuts the mustard in my view. Mm. I think if we are truly a democracy, we should be open and we should be transparent, and that means that you should invite people on the other side in the decision-making process.
And I think...
Or at least their ability to scrutinise and review the decisions that are being made.
One of the things, Misha and Tass, is that, for example, the Articles of Association of Joy allow us to have board meetings virtually. Victorian councils don't have the ability to have their meetings virtually, and Parliament doesn't have the ability to have its meetings virtually. So perhaps that's one of, you know, we need to update that there's no reason that Parliament couldn't sit virtually.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the actual mechanism would be to do that, whether it's sort of a standing orders matter, if it could just meet once and then, you know, create the capacity for that to occur, or what changes would need to occur, but I'm sure it would be doable. The interesting thing is that there's no real enthusiasm for it, you know, federally in Australia in particular. And it's very interesting. We've got, you know, out of all of the sort of, you know, parliamentary democracies, probably the greatest level of contempt for Parliament, you know, out of any in the world. If you look at the UK, for example, the supremacy of Parliament is much stronger there. If you even cast your mind back, say, for example, to the debate over the war in Iraq and the number of backbenchers who stood up in Parliament and criticised Tony Blair, there was a real sense that the Parliament exercised a separate oversight function that sort of transcended party politics. Whereas in Australia, I think there tends to be a culture of whichever party is in power is in power. That's it. Parliament's role is very limited. And you can see that contempt from Parliament in the fact it's not sitting right now.
Yeah. Wanted to move on now, Misha, quickly. The United States primaries, we've seen Bernie Sanders has decided not to continue his campaign. He hasn't actually surrendered his delegates to Joe Biden. So there's still a primary process to go on before, if my understanding is correct, Biden needs obviously a certain number of delegates, which he doesn't have, and in the absence of Bernie pledging his, he still needs to get them. So the US House of Reps and the Congress is sitting, the Senate and the House of Representatives. There's voting going on in a couple of states in primaries and others that's not. What do you know, democracy continues to function in the US, even with that numpty as president, you know, with his three-hour press conferences, which I find so... I think that is a great torture for someone who's broken the, you know, the rules about social distancing. They should be forced to sit down and watch a Donald Trump press conference for 3 hours.
That's right. Look, it's sort of interesting. Just going back to that thing we're discussing with this idea about the supremacy of Parliament,
yeah.
One reason you want to have a Parliament that's supreme is because it's a mechanism to provide accountability for the executives in between elections, right? You know, you only get to vote every 3 years or, you know, in the US every 4 years. And basically, in between that process, to some extent, having separate structures that can hold those people accountable is really important. One of those structures is the media. And, you know, we've seen, for example, with the, you know, police raids on the ABC and News Limited, the way in which the government in Australia, for example, handles the media and is somewhat hostile to its role. We've seen in Scott Morrison a real level of almost aggression towards the media for asking questions. And we've seen that similarly from Donald Trump. You see these super long press conferences where he's disdainful of questions, he's disdainful of scrutiny, he's self-contradictory, he's incoherent. And, you know,
And that's on a good day.
That's right. And my view of all these things is what you want to do is you've obviously got to give leaders the capacity and the space to lead, but at the same time you want to hold them as accountable as possible, you know, while they are doing that, so that, you know, nothing goes too far off track. And unfortunately, the way in which this pandemic has affected the political process is it has sort of upended a lot of things that are going on. So although Bernie Sanders had almost zero chance of getting back against Biden, really the pandemic put an end to all of that. It was almost impossible to campaign. It was impossible to get out his vote. It was very clear that there was no path to victory. So what he's done is basically withdrawn in terms of as a meaningful alternative. He's left his name on the ballot so that he can influence the party and push it towards the left, which I think everybody acknowledges he's done quite successfully in the US. And now Biden is the presumptive nominee, so he can really go hard against Trump and start sort of making his campaign. And that's sort of where we're at. The difficulty in the US is that there's a big issue about what they call voter suppression, the idea that there are rules that make it difficult to get particular voters out. And, you know, one of the things that Trump's doing, for example, is he's very vocal against postal voting because he thinks it might hurt him. So there's a whole bunch of sort of other issues going on that make the US electoral process quite complicated.
Misha, what do you think this means for Trump himself? Where do you think he will land?
Well, again, as I was saying before, something big like this always helps incumbents. And if you look at the opinion polls, it's actually helped Trump a little bit. Even though he said it was a hoax, he insists on calling it the China virus, an incredibly racist language. He's handled it appallingly. Nevertheless, there is a phenomenon where voters will rally around the leader in a time of crisis, and to some extent he's benefiting from that a little bit, much less than other leaders around the world. Scott Morrison's benefiting from it more. Boris Johnson, because he's been unwell, is also benefiting from the fact a lot of public sympathy towards him. So I think it's helping Trump a little bit right now. Whether it helps him by the time we get to the election, it's probably too early to predict.
Misha, if we come back sort of domestically, in my view, our Prime Minister's performance has certainly improved over the last week and a half. Earlier in the piece, you know, he was accused of delivering mixed messages, blundering all over the place, not being very clear. In fact, there's a fair bit of criticism about his performance. But what are your reflections on that? Do you concur with those sentiments?
I think so. I mean, I think to Scott Morrison's credit, he has done a lot better in recent times in terms of taking advice, his sort of deference to experts and expertise, which I think is a really welcome change. I don't know if you remember last year, but around about the time the FODI inquiry into the public service came out, Scott Morrison made a whole bunch of comments which were pretty much along the lines of, I want to bust the Mandarin Club, you know, I want to sort of, public servants should be implementing the policies set by the government, but we're very much in charge. It was almost like a preemptive shot across the bows of, you know, in my view, a part of the system that, you know, had a lot of deep expertise and a lot to offer. And very much, you know, I think Scott Morrison's view is that the political, the politicians should run things, and, you know, people who want to sort of offer independent opinions should be treated with caution. I think he's changed his approach on that. I think he seems in this crisis to have been listening to the experts a lot more, deferring to expertise, really adopting a more evidence-based approach to policy. And I think all of that is to his credit. I think that, you know, although the government was probably slow initially and there were a lot of mistakes made, I think their performance has improved over time. And the early evidence seems to be that we're not doing a bad job of managing the sort of the process of flattening the curve at the moment. So that's definitely to his credit, I think.
Now, Tash won't approve of this, but I had a couple of little bets on the US
election. No, I do not approve.
He doesn't approve. But
I do not approve.
You'll be interested in the odds I got, Misha. This was probably end of last year, so I put $10 on Joe Biden winning the 2020 election, and if he does, I get $1,010. They were pretty good odds. Bernie Sanders, I put $5, and it was $260, so it's nowhere near the other. Donald Trump, $10, and it was, I think, $540. Now, if Elizabeth Warren had won, I'd be getting $8,000. but the popular vote winner, $5 on Trump would pay $15. $5 on Joe Biden would pay $118. That was the odds. That was the odds I got back then.
it sounds like you're like a gambler after my own heart. When I was a kid and I was studying in high school, I used to occasionally bet on the races while I was studying. And what I'd do is I'd go down to the TAB and I'd back basically every horse in the race, so I would almost always win. Now, I'd almost always win slightly less than I invested, but I would still almost always win. And it sounds like you adopted that approach.
Well, there's always a proviso with this. Anything that I win, I actually donate to Joy.
Oh, well, that's good.
So
that's good to see.
I wouldn't get those odds now, Tess, anyway.
No, you probably wouldn't, Macca.
Wouldn't. Look, we're going to have to...
In fact, Macca, you should just donate the money to Joy instead.
Well, yeah, but think if either one of them win, I'm actually going to be... I've invested, I think, $40, and on the basis of if Biden or Trump win, I'm going to end up with $45.
Fantastic.
So, there you go. Of course, if Mike Pence, I was even better.
Misha, it's always great to chat with you. We love having you on the show. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But we will be. You will be back in a couple of weeks' time again, won't you?
I will indeed, and... stay safe, and I hope you have a lovely Easter.
Thank you.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.